Flashback to 2016.
I will say this. We have a great politician here. We have a man here who really helped me. And he's the one person I sought his counsel because he's been so spot on. He's so highly respected. Has anybody ever heard of Senator Jeff Sessions?
Donald Trump was not intimidated. He would not be silenced.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
Flash forward to spring 2017. Jeff Sessions, the newly appointed Attorney General, recuses himself from any investigation into the Trump campaign and Russian involvement in the 2016 election.
Sessions should have never recused himself.
I said, what kind of a man is this? And by the way, he was on the campaign. You know, the only reason I gave him the job, because I felt loyal.
President Trump sent me a clear order. He can send out orders pretty quick.
The Attorney General made a terrible mistake when he did this and when he recused himself, or he should have certainly let us know if he was going to recuse himself. And we would have put a different Attorney General in.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions is firing back at President Trump.
Now calls him Mr. Magoo.
Verona.
He says, as long as I am Attorney General, I will continue to discharge my duties with integrity and honor.
And now to fall 2018.
I could fire everybody right now.
And that's in part what President Trump did. One day after the midterms and just hours after a press conference where he sparred with reporters, the president forced Sessions to resign. In the interim, Matthew Whitaker, Sessions' chief of staff, takes over. Whitaker, however, is a Trump loyalist who's referred to special counsel Robert Mueller's investigators as a lynch mob. So where does this leave the investigation? That's where we begin today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Erin Banko is the national security reporter for The Daily Beast, and she's with me now to help us out. Hi, Erin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Matthew Whitaker steps in to fill Jeff Sessions' role. What do we know about him? One of the things we know is that he's previously questioned the scope of the Mueller investigation. Give us some more in terms of who he is.
Sure. So what we know about Mr. Whitaker is that he's originally from Iowa. He played football for the University of Iowa Hawkeyes, graduated from law school there, and then went on to practice law in his home state before getting involved in, you know, the local political life. He ran for state treasurer of Iowa in 2002 and sort of worked on multiple different presidential campaigns throughout the years before running for a national seat himself for Senate in Iowa in 2014, which he lost. He does have a very, you know, conservative view of the law, which, you know, some people here are taken aback by at times. He was also Attorney General in Iowa in 2004 under George Bush. And so he's well known and even liked in the Department of Justice. However, from my sources inside the department, you know, several people I spoke to said he's perhaps even more conservative in terms of his view of the law than Sessions.
Erin Banko is a national security reporter for The Daily Beast. Erin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
The president's actions on Wednesday called back to a different time in Washington.
The country tonight is in the midst of what may be the most serious constitutional crisis in its history. The president has fired the special Watergate prosecutor, Archibald Cox. Because of the president's action, the attorney general has resigned. Elliot Richardson has quit, saying he cannot carry out Mr. Nixon's instructions.
For some deeper historical context now, we go to Stuart Gerson, former acting and assistant U.S. Attorney General. He's currently a partner in the law firm of Epstein Becker Green. Stuart, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So I'd love to start with your perspective on the change in oversight of the Mueller investigation. Now that Whitaker is taking over, where does that leave the investigation? Where does that leave Rosenstein?
Well, for one thing, it leaves Rosenstein theoretically out of the loop entirely, though he'll no doubt download Whitaker as to what he's been doing. But most of this is foreshadowing. It's anticipation. No telling how long that Whitaker is going to be acting attorney general, given on the doubt as to who ultimately will be the nominee and the likely desire of the Senate to take some time, at least the minority in the Senate, to take some time in the evaluation of that individual. Whitaker could be around for a while. As to Mueller and his investigation, we have to see. But it is quite possible, among the list of alternatives, for the investigation to be truncated or even terminated.
And what's your take on Whitaker? I mean, how did he move up the ranks, if you will, to hold this role?
Well, this is not a giant in the law. This is somebody who has been moved up because of a political connection. Apparently, he got the attention of the president when he wrote an op-ed for one of the networks with respect to the scope of the Mueller investigation. He got into the loop, at least at that point. He's been known as a Trump supporter, coming from Iowa, having been the U.S. attorney in Iowa and having worked to promote the candidacy and policy of Donald Trump. He was somebody who was rumored to even be in line to be White House counsel. The way he got plugged in at Justice was at one of the points when now former Attorney General Sessions threatened to resign. There was a resolution of that. I believe it involved the Chief of Staff. And at that time, the White House named Mr. Whitaker as the Chief of Staff to the Attorney General. And at that point, at least according to the White House Chief of Staff, the President's Chief of Staff, Mr. Whitaker became the White House's eyes and ears at the Justice Department.
Let's talk a little bit about historical precedent here. Stuart, you were Assistant U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia during the Watergate crisis when President Richard Nixon ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire independent prosecutor Archibald Cox. This is something known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Can you give us a sense for what we're seeing now and whether that is parallel to what happened then?
Well, I was around during that time, which proves nothing more than that I'm old. But of course, the United States Attorney's Office was out of the mix at that time, having prosecuted the early cases and then having a special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, in place. And then President Nixon decided that the walls were coming down around him and he had to go. The Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, who was ordered to fire him, refused to do so and resigned. So too did the Deputy Attorney General, Bill Ruckelshaus, who also resigned. As the cards kept falling, the third in line was the Solicitor General, who was Robert Bork, and ultimately Judge Bork, decided that it had to stop at some point, his own views aside, and he fired the special prosecutor, Cox. And in part, that ended up bringing down President Nixon, who had his own problems directly with the Senate Select Committee and Sam Ervin and Howard Baker. Is it analogous to the present? Well, we'll find out. If one assumes that the president takes what will be a highly politically controversial step and orders whoever is the attorney general at the time to fire Robert Mueller, who is in roughly the same position as the special prosecutor was during the Nixon administration. Mueller is a Justice Department person. He's not an independent agent. Then the attorney general can do that. The president certainly has the power to do that. It raises the interesting question of whether this acting attorney general will continue to be involved in the matter, and if so, for how long. It looks that way, notwithstanding requests that he recuse himself because he's stated an opinion publicly about the investigation. But theoretically, it could come down to the same sort of thing. And would Rosenstein then be in charge, or would it go down to the Solicitor General, who's Noel Francisco? Time will only tell. There certainly will be a continued tension as the Democrats have taken over the majority in the House of Representatives and will now lead the House Intelligence Committee, which is going to be a great deal more active under the Democratic chairman than it has been under Mr. Nunez, who will recede into the background.
And I'm wondering, we know that the president, President Trump, has been frustrated with Attorney General Sessions. That's no secret. And I'm sure, you know, we're thinking, is Robert Mueller preparing to conclude his investigation after what happened this week? Do you think precipitate that?
It could, but I will say this. I have a very high opinion of Robert Mueller and his integrity and his ability. His office has been operating seamlessly. There have been no leaks at all, let alone any of consequence. I am sure that he and his very capable staff have planned for all contingencies, are moving ahead on the merits and nothing else. Keep in mind, though, that the Mueller investigation is not the only investigation that is out there. You have the situation with Mr. Cohen in the Southern District of New York, and other cases could be farmed out to other United States attorneys' offices. I mean, we don't know the full scope of what is being examined. People opine all the time about it without any direct knowledge. But I think it's fair to say that Bob Mueller and his lieutenants have thought through the various contingencies. The ultimate issue that we'll all face, that we'll all at least be witness to, is whether, A, there will be any report from Mr. Mueller, and if there is, the extent to which that will be circulated. And time will only tell with respect to that, but you can be sure that there'll be plenty of action and noise with respect to attempts by the Congress, by the press, and others, ultimately to find out everything that the Mueller investigation considered and knew, and conversely by the administration attempting, and oftentimes properly, to rest on attorney-client privilege and not make certain things public.
And the president has also had the option to fire Robert Mueller. Does that seem more likely given this week's events?
It's hard to know. I mean, I would think in the first instance, strategically, the president would want to avoid the political controversy in doing so and might be more interested in just limiting the scope of the investigation and having it come to an end. And maybe that is the thing that Mr. Whitaker is going to pursue. But none of us is a mind reader, and time will only tell. But I don't think that time is far off.
And ultimately, I'm wondering if this could hurt the presidency in similar ways in which it hurt the presidency under Richard Nixon.
Well, you make the right point that the ultimate issue is the stature and ability of the presidency, not a particular president. And both sides keep that in mind. I mean, many of the things that are controversial that this administration does are done by every administration with regard to maintaining separation of powers, keeping a hold of its own prerogatives, even in the wake of requests for documents and the like of that by the legislature. Ultimately, though, if these things reach the court or there's doubt cast on the ability of whoever is the president and his agents at the time, that weakens the presidency. It weakens these precedents and customary practices, which are beneficial, and ultimately has a deleterious and negative result in terms of the public interest.
Stuart Gerson is former acting and assistant U.S. Attorney General and currently a partner in the law firm of Epstein, Becker, Green. Stuart, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tanzina.
When President Trump took office, there were 112 federal judicial vacancies, and he was quite eager to fill them.
It was like the gift from heaven. We were left judges. They're the ones that judge on your disputes. They judge on what's fair on the environment and what's not fair, where they're going to take your farms and factories away and where they're not. Amazing. It was the gift. Thank you very much, President Obama. We all appreciate it.
Filling judicial vacancies with conservative judges has been one of the top priorities for Republicans in the Trump era, and the president has moved fast to get it done. Now that Republicans have strengthened their hold of the Senate, which is where judicial appointees get confirmed, the administration shows no signs of stopping. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, dozens of races across the country gave seats to judges in places like North Carolina, West Virginia, and Arkansas. And the strategy for filling those seats, well, there's a lot to it. Alicia Bannon is going to help us unpack it all. She's the deputy director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Alicia, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get started. There was a lot to talk about here. The judicial race results on a state-by-state basis. Were there some themes that emerged in your view?
Sure. Well, we saw several states have quite high-cost, highly politicized judicial races. You know, one thing that was very striking was how much outside money was pouring into those races. So rather than candidates taking out ads directly, you had outside groups, often funded by special interests, putting hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars into television advertisements. And strikingly, we usually don't know much about the donors behind those groups.
That was going to be my question. Who are these groups and what types of groups are funding these judges? We don't know yet.
Well, you know, a lot of the money is dark money. So in a lot of cases, we don't know who the underlying donors are. When we have been able to unpeel the onion and kind of follow the money, not surprisingly, it's frequently interests that are regularly appearing before those state courts. So we see a lot of money coming from plaintiff side trial lawyers on the one side. We see a lot of money coming from business interests on the other. One thing that's really striking is there have been several instances where you'll have actual cases pending before the very judges that are standing for election. So there's a lot of really troubling conflicts of interest that come out of these big money judicial races.
I was just going to say, this doesn't feel exactly like it's on the up and up here. Who is in charge of making sure that these conflicts of interest don't interfere with our judicial system, or is no one in charge of that?
Well, a problem is that in states across the country, the rules governing when judges are supposed to step aside from cases in the face of these conflicts of interest have not caught up to the realities of how these races now function. So most states don't have clear rules governing when big money election, when if a litigant or lawyer has spent a lot of money supporting a judge, when that judge might have to step aside from the case. And even fewer have rules governing what happens if that money came through outside spending.
Do we know? I feel like there are lots of, when even here in New York, there was a lot of conversation about flipping the ballot and making sure you're voting, you know, for these judges. How much are Americans informed about the judicial process here? How much do we know about how much our vote actually matters to the judges?
Well, I think all too often these races fly under the radar. You know, many people don't know even the names of their state Supreme Court justices. These are extremely important positions. You know, 95% of all cases are decided in state courts, and state Supreme Courts are the final word on most state law decisions. So these are really high stakes issues. But frankly, usually the only people that are paying attention are kind of the special interests that have a strong financial interest in these cases. The public, you know, which also obviously has a very strong interest in how these cases are decided, you know, tends not to be very informed or even have access to information about these judges.
And let's look at the federal picture now. At the top of the show, we know that President Trump has been very excited about filling the vacancies that he has available to him. What did the midterm results tell us about his efforts potentially going forward to fill those vacancies?
Well, I think that it's quite likely that we're going to see, if anything, a kind of acceleration of efforts to confirm judges. You know, the Republicans have lost the House of Representatives, which means that I think they're going to have a harder time moving forward any big legislative initiatives. But they've actually strengthened their hand in the Senate, which is the body that confirms judges. And so I think that what we're likely to see is just a lot more attention paid towards just getting through as many judges as possible. Right now, we have 135 vacancies across the country in our federal courts. So, you know, they're poised to have quite a profound effect on the shape of the federal judiciary for, you know, decades to come.
What's the strategy, I guess, as you mentioned, the Senate is now in Republican control. What's the strategy for Democrats, for more progressive or for liberals to combat that? Or can they even come up with a strategy to do that, given that the Senate is not under their control?
I mean, I think the Democrats are in a challenging position right now. I think there are ways that they can potentially slow down the process and insist that there is sufficient kind of vetting of nominees, you know, insist that the hearings are done in a meaningful way. But, you know, a lot of the tools that the minority party used to have to basically have a voice in the process have been weakened or taken away. So just, you know, for example, it used to be that a home state senator would be able to say, we don't want a particular nominee to move forward because we haven't been consulted on that nominee. And now under Chuck Grassley, they've essentially eliminated that rule. So now home state senators no longer have a meaningful opportunity to say, we don't believe that this nominee should go forward because we haven't been consulted.
There are about two more years left under this presidency and in this administration. We've just went through the midterms. What do you think the landscape is going to look like for the courts to fill those vacancies by the end of the Trump presidency?
So the landscape among how kind of advocates and others are going to be looking at the courts, one thing that's been very striking, and this has been true for decades, is that there's been a real asymmetry of interest. So people on the right, and this goes for both members of the public all the way up to, you know, our elected officials, have really viewed the courts as a priority, and they just haven't gotten the same amount of attention on the left. I think that may be changing. I think particularly Justice Kavanaugh's recent confirmation was a real call to action for a lot of people that, you know, they've not been paying enough attention to how high stakes these nominations really are, and that, you know, they frankly haven't been voting on judges. They haven't been viewing that as a real election issue. And I think there is kind of growing attention, and that's been borne out. We've seen even in judicial races where folks on the left have been paying more attention.
Alicia Bannon is deputy director at the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Alicia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Another mass shooting in the United States, this time in the city of Thousand Oaks, just 40 miles northwest of downtown Los Angeles. Shortly after 11 p.m. local time, police received 911 calls from the Borderline Bar, where witnesses say a man entered and started shooting. He killed 12 people, including a sheriff's deputy who was the first law enforcement officer to enter the bar. The gunman is also dead. The bar was packed with young people who were there for a college night and country two-step lessons. Here's one witness speaking to a local ABC News affiliate.
And there were just young people, like young, 18, 19, 20, just having a great time. And this maniac came in and started shooting people for no reason at all. These people have never hurt anybody in their lives. They're just... kids. They're just kids. I'm so sorry.
We reached Claudia Bill de la Peña, a council member for the city of Thousand Oaks.
I was already asleep, and I received a phone call shortly after it happened. And of course, I got ready and then headed out.
What can you tell those of us who haven't been to Thousand Oaks about Thousand Oaks? What kind of community is it?
It is a bedroom community. It is absolutely wonderful. It is outside of Los Angeles. And once you drive through the congested valley and into Ventura County, you just have this big relief and take a deep breath because you know you have entered an area that is just filled with nature, hills, and low density. It's not congested at all. It is really paradise.
Have you spoken to community members yet today? Can you give us a sense of what the reaction has been so far?
The reaction is one of shock and disbelief that this can happen in our community. And this is something that you hear in communities across America. We didn't think it could happen here, but it does. So our community is in shock and we are mourning.
You tweeted that families are being sent to a local center to be reunited with their children who were at the bar. What can you tell us so far about those efforts?
Well, we are coordinating with various law enforcement agencies, and we do have family members here, loved ones here, and they're all awaiting word.
And we're hearing that many of the people who were in the bar last night were young people in their late teens and early 20s. Can you tell us anything about the bar itself, how long it had been in the community, and what type of place it was?
Well, the bar, Borderline Bar and Grill, really is the only country western bar in Thousand Oaks, and it's been around for decades. It is a place where the community comes together. In fact, we had a very big event just a couple of months ago, a charity event. The bar makes itself available to charity events, and it is quite the local staple. And it was college night, so everybody there was over the age of 18.
And as a local government member, how do you expect the Thousand Oaks community to respond? What, in addition to the reunification efforts, are you all thinking about as this story unfolds?
Well, first of all, we need to take care of the families who are impacted by this. Everything is still fresh. We don't have all the answers yet. We are making every effort and help available to the families, those who are waiting to hear from their loved ones. and we have to wait for that process to finish before we can move on to the next. But in the meantime, our committee members have reached out with offers of help in any way that they can.
How are you personally feeling today, Councilmember?
Well, I'm extremely saddened that this can happen in our wonderful bedroom community of 130,000 people, always one of America's safest cities until today.
Claudia Bill de la Peña is a council member for the city of Thousand Oaks. Council member, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
On Tuesday night, the state of Kansas turned out some unexpected results. Democrat Laura Kelly was elected governor, defeating Republican Secretary of State and Trump ally Kris Kobach. And Charisse Davids was elected to the House of Representatives. She'll be the first lesbian Native American woman to serve in Congress. In 2016, 56% of Kansans voted for President Trump. So with the midterm election results in the books, what, if anything, have we learned about rural voters? Joining me now is Sarah Smarsh, a Kansas-based journalist and author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So how do you explain the results in Kansas on Tuesday?
Well, there are a couple of things. First, I would begin with what I believe is a national trend, just a robust effort on the ground, often by people who weren't previously paying attention or being active as citizens, really rising up, hitting the streets, canvassing, even moderate Republicans here in Kansas, often crossing the aisle to make sure that what they saw as a dangerous strain of conservatism didn't win out in the 2018 midterms. And they seem to have had some success in those efforts. And in addition to that, I think, you know, I would caution your listeners from viewing places that we call red states as monolithically conservative. And so for folks like me on the ground, it's actually not as surprising as it might be to people who rely on a national graphic of our nation that is essentially red and blue squares to guide their vision of the political character and makeup of the country. There have always been a lot of Democrats on the ground here in Kansas and in all red states. And the inverse is true as far as Republicans in so-called blue states. And historically, in this country, those slight majorities and slight minorities essentially kind of swing back and forth in their ability to win out. And we had a couple of wins for the blue side this time in Kansas.
And what do we know about non-white voters in Kansas? Because to your point, I do think that the media is equally guilty of this, of calling states red or blue and assuming that we know everything about the people that are in those states. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would imagine a lot of the narrative around Kansas is not just that it's rural voters, but that it's also white rural voters. What do we know about non-white voters in Kansas?
Well, here in Kansas, and this is true of a lot of largely agricultural and rural states, we see a dwindling population in terms of trends over not just the last few decades, but really going back to the Industrial Revolution, rural flight has been an issue. And these are states that have been dominated by essentially the descendants of poor white European immigrants long ago. And that population shifted toward cities. And in more recent decades, we have seen an influx of people of color immigrants, often in my part of the country, coming up from Mexico. In western Kansas, our robust meatpacking industry also has a lot of immigrants from even the Middle East and elsewhere. So there are parts of western Kansas Texas that is as rural as you could get, no major metropolis within hours, that are actually white minority locations. And we actually, in one of those places, Dodge City, saw some nefarious efforts at what would seem to be voter suppression by some of the white county officials. The extent to which those efforts were successful remains to be seen, but every report was that ultimately folks were able to access the polls and vote. And we know that here in Kansas, just like everywhere in the country, people of color are more likely to vote Democratic than Republican.
I'm wondering if that had anything to do with some of the results that we saw. We saw not just in Kansas, but Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois elected Democrats to governor. Do you think that indicates that there's a pendulum shift happening in some of these Midwestern states?
I do think there is a pendulum shift, and part of that actually, in my view, has to do with candidates like, while Beto O'Rourke didn't end up winning in Texas, I think he kind of exemplifies an effort to reach every county, progressives and Democrats going into places where folks from that side of the aisle for years were kind of leaving for political dead and saying, I'm showing up for you, let's talk. And I think that that has made some inroads in communities that previously were maybe just kind of under the spell of Fox News or voting a straight ticket Republican in a kind of tribal way. Now, you asked about the rural urban split, and that does in the numbers continue to bear out as a phenomenon here in Kansas, at least. And so you do see, you know, even those places in western Kansas that are quickly diversifying, still ultimately Kris Kobach received more votes than Laura Kelly. And when you look at the map, it is again the places where that are most populous, where we have some modestly sized cities in Kansas and some universities in the mix, where the county shows up as blue with Kelly winning out. But I do think that the gradient of the intensity of that red is lessening in the rural places. And that has to do both with a population shift and with earnest efforts by candidates to reach those places with a progressive message.
Let's talk a little bit about the issues that are most important to Kansans. Are we talking about the economy? Are we talking about jobs? What are some of the issues that are top of mind for folks that you think aren't coming across at the national level?
Sure. Well, Laura Kelly really won by saying, I'm going to protect public schools. I'm going to fight for Medicaid expansion in this state where thousands and thousands of people have suffered in that loophole for lack of Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act, and build infrastructure, roads. Not necessarily a hard economic message, but a message about public services and ability to access programs that even a moderately conservative state appreciates about government for the sake of their children and their family's health. And she also very successfully pinned Kris Kobach to our recent governor, Sam Brownback's very far-right tact, specifically on the economy with tax cuts. And that message really spoke to people. And meanwhile, Kris Kobach couldn't have been a more Trumpian candidate in his very harsh focus on immigration and vilification of immigrants, really. He had previously led the now defunct so-called voter fraud task force for the Trump administration. So he was really had a message about a xenophobic message that was attempting to tap into people's fear. And Kelly went with progress and focused on what she knew that everyone in Kansas would appreciate from their state government. And ultimately, that message won out.
Sarah Smarsh is a Kansas-based journalist and the author of Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
In the lead up to Tuesday's midterm elections, many candidates made health care a central focus of their campaigns. But in Utah, Nebraska, and Idaho, voters got the chance to decide whether or not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act through a ballot initiative. And in all three of those deep red states, voters said yes. Tammy Luby is a senior writer for CNN covering health policy. Tammy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, Tanzina.
How notable is it that all of these states were conservative?
This is a pretty impressive, you know, move by all of these states. You know, Medicaid was a big winner in the election on Tuesday night. So you had these three states through grassroots ballot initiatives, people going around the states for months encouraging people to sign up. And, you know, they first had to get it on the ballot, which was impressive to begin with. They did that. And then they encouraged people to go to the polls. And In fact, people voted to expand. They went around the state legislatures who have resisted expanding Medicaid in these states, and they approved it.
So, and these aren't the first Republican states to adopt Medicaid expansion, even though the Republicans have sort of, under a different name, called this, you know, to demonize it in many ways as Obamacare. But does this tell us anything about changing attitudes towards the Affordable Care Act?
Right. Well, until recently, we did have 31 states plus the District of Columbia who had expanded, and many of those states included Republican governors. You had Michigan, Ohio, Arizona, North Dakota, New Mexico. So, and in fact, even last year, when President Trump and Congress were looking to repeal the Affordable Care Act and make changes, you know, to Medicaid expansion, repeal it in some cases or just change it, a lot of Republican governors wrote letters to their to Congress, to their representatives, saying, wait a minute, this is important to our residents. Don't do this or think twice.
And there were a couple states on Tuesday that flipped from Republican governors to Democratic governors. I'm thinking of Maine in particular, where voters were voting to expand Medicaid, but the Republican governor didn't allow that to go through. Do you think we could see more expansion of Medicaid after by states run by Democrats?
Definitely. I mean, Maine is, you know, a perfect example. This was actually the first state to have a ballot initiative to expand it, and it passed last year, but yet there is no Medicaid expansion in Maine because the governor, Republican Paula Page, has blocked it. But now voters put in Janet Mills, who's a Democrat. They also flipped the state Senate to Democratic control. So now it looks like Maine is shortly going to have Medicaid expansion. Plus, you have states like Kansas, where the Republican state legislature last year actually passed Medicaid expansion, but it was blocked by then-Governor Sam Brownback. And now Laura Kelly, who ran on expanding Medicaid, will probably try to push it through again.
What does this tell us about how the Republican strategy might change about healthcare in general? Is it going to be different messaging? Are they going to call it a different name? Like, what does this tell? Because it seems like people really want their healthcare.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if this changes Republicans' attitudes towards Medicaid. But certainly we've seen in the last election that it's changed their attitudes towards at least part of the Affordable Care Act, you know, because these protections for people with pre-existing conditions became a key issue in the midterm elections. The Democrats were, you know, attacking their Republican rivals as saying that they wanted to take away the protections by shedding the Affordable Care Act. That's not going to happen now. You know, we have a divided Congress, so the Affordable Care Act generally is safe, in at least from the lawmakers, although the Trump administration is still making changes. But
they're also promising they want to bring prescription drug prices down. Like, are they just kind of rebranding Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
I think they're realizing that healthcare in America has changed and they're not going to be able to go back to the pre-ACA days. They're going to have to protect pre-existing conditions. And yes, healthcare going forward is going to be very important. You had both Trump and Pelosi yesterday mention that they want to start working on lowering drug prices, which has been a big focus for both parties.
Well, we'll see what they end up doing. Tammy Luby is a senior writer for CNN covering health policy. Tammy, thank you again.
Thank you.
So how should we grade the election's media coverage? If you sat in front of the television on Tuesday night, chances are it felt like a roller coaster. Out of the gate, Democrats were leading. Soon after, Republicans made a comeback. Up and down and up and down, there was a blue wave stalled by a red wall and roundtables of pundits offering their predictions. But prior to Tuesday, there was also months' worth of diligent and in-depth reporting across outlets that attempted to get the story right and not overlook voting blocks that were undercovered or simply misunderstood in the past. But did we, the media, get it right? Alex Perrine is a writer for HuffPost and the former editor-in-chief of Gawker. Alex, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
All right, so the big question, we're going to be a little self-critical here. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the coverage leading up to Tuesday. Where did you think the picture was well reported?
I thought what was done well was I was actually sort of surprised to see media outlets, professional, like mainstream nonpartisan media outlets, actually willing to call out what I saw as extremely racist campaigning on the part of the Republican Party, because you don't always see that because there's sort of a taboo against using the R word in the professional media. So it was actually heartening to see that, for example, the Notorious Caravan ad was actually called, as it was, basically racist propaganda. So I was heartened to see that. And there, I think there was very good coverage of obstacles set up to voting in by Brian Kemp and in other places across the country. So I think, you know, if depending on what media sources you were following and what you were reading, I think you would get a pretty good picture of what the state of the campaign was leading up to Tuesday.
Where did you think were some of the gaps?
Well, like I said, it was good to see individual stories call things like the caravan ad racist, but I thought it was harder to see people putting together a coherent narrative of the entire race. From the what I saw was the entire message of the Republican Party. There was no policy involved, really. Their campaign was essentially stoking racial paranoia. And I think reporters and editors are much more comfortable calling individual pieces of a campaign racist than they are saying, well, boy, the entire strategy, like the entire strategy top to bottom is just stoking white fear. So you saw it in individual stories, but again, people didn't always put everything in context.
Also, we can't have a conversation about, well, we were only going to have a conversation about the media coverage up until the midterms. And then there was a pretty intense press conference that happened yesterday following the midterms. The president began the press conference in what I thought was quite a muted tone. He seemed tired and just sort of, you know, not really his usual bombastic self. And then the Q&A came. And then we saw a sparring between the president and multiple reporters. There was one reporter who asked him specifically about nationalism, and he called her said that was a racist question. So there we go. We get to bring in the R word. But then we saw this back and forth between one of the president's, I would say, favorite targets, if you will, and that was Jim Acosta. Let's play a short clip from that.
I think you should let me run the country. You run CNN. All right. And if you did it well, your ratings would be
much
better.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks, pardon me, ma'am, that you may have
I'm not concerned about anything with the Russian investigation because it's a hoax. That's enough. Put down the mic. I'll tell you what, CNN should be ashamed of itself having you working for them. You are a rude, terrible person. You shouldn't be working for CNN.
And just to update our listeners here, since that press conference, the White House has revoked Jim Acosta's security access badge to getting into the White House. When the American public sees something like that, what kind of impact does that have on their perception of the White House press corps, of the media in general?
Yeah, I don't mean to demean the work that people like Jim Acosta do, but President Trump is... and the White House are basically, they're doing professional wrestling. And it was, from their perspective, they're just creating a theatrical moment. And what people are going to come away with wildly divergent takes of what happened there. And I think that's sort of their intention. The intention is to heighten polarization. And so you're... average liberal American is going to be outraged on behalf of the media. And then your average Trump supporter is just going to be saying, all right, like, let's do it. Like, get them. And it's
them being the press.
Yeah, get the press. Yeah. And it's been part of their entire media strategy since the very beginning is to sort of stoke these fights. And it's an easy trap to fall into because obviously – having access to the White House and having a press that is able to do its job is a hugely important First Amendment issue. But at the same time, everyone keeps being dragged into these fights that are essentially just about theatrics that are done purely for the benefit of the White House.
I'm wondering, too, how much should we be covering these things, right? There's a sense that we can't – this presidency has really brought a different tone, a different tenor to be generous to handling these. And so how much – do you think the media should be covering the media?
It's a tough question. And I think the media errs on the side of covering itself too much a lot. And I say this as a person who basically writes about it professionally for a living. So I'm kind of being hypocritical here. But there are ways in which it's the only way the media can get at the story of how unusual and extreme this White House is by telling stories of how weird its relationship with the press is, in a sense, because that's what they're more comfortable saying. Well, this is an unprecedented treatment of us by the White House, so this White House is therefore like breaking all these norms, because they're just more comfortable going there than they are saying something like that about policy issues or about other things like that. So I totally understand the incentives that lead to covering these press conferences the way they're covered, and they are news. but they're certainly not the most consequential news that's going on in the country. So if I was in charge of CNN, I don't really know exactly how I would be treating things like these press conferences, which are staged to cause incidents, but are also themselves news.
You mentioned CNN. I full disclosure, I worked at CNN for a few years before coming here. The punditry issue, and this is not limited to CNN. We see this on MSNBC. We see this on most of the cable news stations. These are folks that are really essentially trying to fill 24 hours worth of airtime, which is quite a while to talk about things. How much is the punditry at large, if you will, hurting the conversation? Because I think even CNN said they might try to walk back some pundits who are really paid political contributors.
Yeah, that's sort of galling, I think. If you're a viewer, you don't always know what the interests are of the person talking on your television. 24-hour cable news is an attempt to fill that much time with people talking in debate. And I think it's not particularly good for informing the public to turn news into basically a sports call-in show, which it feels like much of the time. But that's debate is what leads to ratings. And they bring in people who are basically professional Trump supporters who then say outrageous things, because that's part of being a professional Trump supporter, is to cause outrage and say divisive and extreme things. And then they pat themselves on the back, the anchors for saying that's out of line. But you are hosting this circus, like you organized the circus, and then you get very outraged when like the clowns show up and do their routine. There are certainly better models for debate based political coverage, and I think like those models exist certainly on like public radio and lots of other places. I don't know if those models are as good for the sort of ratings they want to get in this era.
Talk about another one last media issue here. The emphasis on, in any election year, there's always an emphasis on the sleeping giant of Latino voters, for example, right? This year in particular, we saw, if anything, Latinos were a critical part of the news cycle, everything from Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rican voters, to what was happening at the southern border, to the detention camps that had been set up. And so what was stunning to me, and I think a lot of other folks, was the lack or the void of Latino punditry, if you will, or folks who were able to really speak to these issues. And let me be clear, Latino journalists do not have to cover immigration, right? Often the time that they're brought in. But did you notice a lack of representation of the issues when it came to people of color, specifically this sort of these monolithic groups that get covered and then don't get asked to sit at the table for the analysis of what's happening?
Yeah, and that's, you can sort of already picture in your head a cable news panel discussing the refugee crisis. That's like five white guys. Like you can picture that in your head very clearly, and because it's typical. And if anything, in the Trump era, once he got elected, these channels sort of were like, oh, we got to get a couple more white guys in here because that was the story we missed last time around, was all these angry white conservatives. So we better get some more of them in here. It's obviously an endemic problem in big media. I would say there's at least a lot of alternative outlets to go to if you want more diverse coverage. And, you know, to speak of the media and refer only to cable news is to sort of miss that. I don't really think a ton of young people of color in this country are actually watching a lot of cable news at all. I think they're getting their news elsewhere. And I think that will eventually be a crisis for these outlets that we're talking about. And then they're going to wish that they had actually done something more to address the diversity of their own channels beforehand.
Alex Perrine is the former editor at Gawker and currently writing for HuffPost. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.